Guys, I'm delighted that Michael's here to see us, and I'm not going to spend too long introducing him because I haven't spoken to him about what he's going to deliver on. He's spent some time doing that himself to set the scene. I've heard lots of positive stuff about him, and as I say, I'm looking forward to seeing him. So, if you mind putting your hands just together to welcome Michael, please.
Morning. Firstly, it's a huge pleasure to be here. It's not the first time I've come north, four or five times over the last few years, and it's been great. There's some familiar faces in the room. It's, as I say, a pleasure to be asked to speak, but then you have the difficulty of saying, okay, what are you going to talk about? So I apologise if the presentation jumps around a bit. There'll be some videos in there, but I'll try to give everybody in the room maybe one or two things they can take away. So I've just come back from this place. So obviously a very unique place. But before I sort of talk about that, I probably want to go back a little bit. So understanding my thought process, leaving Liverpool to go to Sao Paulo, what I was trying to get out of it, a little bit about how my pathway has not been linear to that stage. So I believe in this. I believe in you versus yourself as a model for development. And that drives my philosophy on developing players, but also my personal obsession for learning and improvement. So I see everything as you versus yourself. And I think individual development is team development. I'm not sure if team development is individual, if you catch my drift on that. So that's a big theme for me as we go through our chat. I think this is really important. So the more and more I'm learning, it's about people, the situations that I've been in the last 3 or 4 years of dealing with young players. I think it's a human science rather than a sport science. So I think that's a lovely quote from Jose Mourinho. I think it's not about how talented someone is, it's how the talent is handled. And I think this quote down here, the person comes first. 99.9% of clubs don't care enough for the person, a big quote from Cruyff. The art of one-to-one is now more important than ever. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. Look for players you can go on a journey with, show interest in them as people, not just footballers. And a nice one from Jurgen Klopp, which he said on his first day with Liverpool, is don't impress me, impress yourself. So this thing of you versus yourself being very prominent in sort of my ideas for player and personal development. So, my journey so far. There's two journeys, really. There's this one that started as a part-time coach at Chelsea, putting out the cones down here for the under-6s that led to running that programme and working for the age group. A big thing for me was 2007 when I went full-time. So I was overseeing the 6-9s programme, taking the under-10s, then the 13s, 14s for a few years. Had a chance meeting with a guy called Frank McParland, who was the academy manager at Liverpool on holiday in Mallorca. I was renting the villa off a Scouse chap that lives there. So it was Frank. So we sort of met at a cafeteria. My parents live in Mallorca, so it was their cafeteria. We sort of met there without knowing I was going to meet him. And that led to coming to Liverpool in September of 2012. Originally as head of 16s or 15s programme, running the two teams, selecting the players to obviously be a full-time scholar, but quickly after about 2 months moving up to assist the under-21s and then taking them for 3 years, which become the under-23s, before January going to Sao Paulo assistant manager. But that's one sort of journey, which includes working across the three clubs and different age groups, but that's not really the truth. The truth is this, that when I was part-time at Chelsea, I was a young player at Cholton that just fell below the grades. I fell into the non-league game. I did a level two. I started a soccer school in a church hall coaching futsal. Cost me £30 the hour. I had 3 kids come at £4 each, so I was £18 down. It wasn't the best business plan I've ever thought of. But it grew from there. Every non-league player in London at the time was also a postman. It was like the job for non-league players. You go on the post in the morning, you got finished early on the Saturdays, you go and play. I was a postman for about 4 weeks, I've got to be honest. It wasn't a job that suited me at all, but I was running a soccer school, being a non-league player. I read some books in between, had a website, ran a men's pub team while I was working part-time at Chelsea, worked at Crystal Palace Football in the Community with my B licence. To do my A licence, you had to manage a team or a youth team, something that was in the FA Cup. So Chelsea ladies and Chelsea ladies reserves enabled me to take my A licence at a young age, probably around the age of 23. The Crystal Palace ladies as well. So Crystal Palace ladies were on the different nights to Chelsea part-time stuff. AFC Women's Under 19 was a college programme during the day. So I was running the college programme during the day, soccer school in the afternoon, working at Chelsea in the evening. On the alternate nights, I was working Crystal Palace lady. To get that break there, that's really my big break, because now I could just focus on the one job, the one club. So when you see this, it wasn't actually like that. This was all going on at the time. So it was definitely a part-time salary, full-time commitment, or a passion, obsession, is what I would say. Big thing here come when I left to go to Liverpool. Chelsea were very good payers in youth development, so if you get a chance to pay well, much better than Liverpool. So that was a big decrease in salary to go. I'll tell you the exact amount. It was significant because I had a young family. I had a four-month-old son. My first son, Henry, we moved from London to Liverpool. I was a big Chelsea fan as a boy, but the opportunity to go and push myself on was a big one. And I was out of my comfort zone. Very much a cocky Cockney, now going up to Scouseland and trying to fit in. It was interesting at the time. But it was the best decision I ever made. And then this decision here, in November or early December of 2016, to go across to another culture, country, language, leaving the top club and job. That all these decisions here to make this move and this one is because when I first started coaching back down here as a 21-year-old, I had big aims for here. I wanted to work abroad. I wanted to learn a second language. I was obsessed by that. I had a little bit of a trial period at FC 20 when I finished at Cheltenham, which blew me away in terms of a different thinking and idea of football. So it was something that I was very passionate about. When I looked at British coaches that had gone abroad, they were the people that I was using as sort of like my guiding light, if you want. So when people say, where are you going to be in 5 years? Well, the 18th of September is an interesting date, because on the 18th of September 2012, I joined Liverpool. On the 18th of September 2017, I rejoined Liverpool in a completely different position. So when I say, where are you going to be in 5 years? I don't know. I did quite a lot of varied things in there. I think one thing you'd say about this game is working with the right people in a project you really believe in. So listen to Gavin and Stephen speaking earlier. You can see the passion and belief they have for their club, which I think gets you out of bed in the morning. So there are things I would say, happy in your job. I don't really know where you set these 5 years aims for yourself, and I don't know. You just want to push yourself on, but ultimately the people you surround yourself with and the project are really, really important. So I'd say learning via experience, really, and I'll use Liverpool as the example, and the quality needed to be a successful guide. So I think my job is to be a guide to the players rather than a coach or a teacher. I quite like the word guide. So if I use that, in the time I was there, we were quite lucky. The club was in transition from a different time, and I think a lot of players initially under Brendan got opportunities here. So the players in red are players that come from outside, and the players in white are the players that come from inside. I think it's a 13 and 12 split. So 25 players made debuts over 5 years. It's no secret that one's not stuck yet. There's players there that we don't fight a lot of money for, but no one's stuck. If I give you ideas of managing the under-23s and the different types of players you would manage, you had the boys that have gone on the full journey, from under-7. So the six lads there that have gone from under-7 to the first team and made their debut, all still at the club. I was lucky enough to go and watch young Connor yesterday. He was playing for Hearts up at Dundee. So you had that type of boy that knew the club very well, and we'd seen the full development of them. You had this type. These are boys that come from outside, which is inevitable when you're at a larger club. So you have Shay Ojo coming from MK Dons, young Jerome Sinclair coming from West Brom. And there was many more, but you had some boys coming from overseas as well, notably Canyos from Barcelona, Chirivella from Valencia. And then you had low-risk projects of boys that we saw that were maybe released from another club. And there was three there, Kevin Stewart, Ovie Ajari and Sam Hart, that came in from three clubs. Now, the reason I'll tell you about the three types is is they all have different personalities, cultures and expectations. And when you're managing them boys just before the first heat, it's a bit like spinning plates. So you're stopping heads from wobbling off. So you're over here and you're spinning this plate just before, but just as you've dealt with this player, this one's head's coming off over here and this one over here. So you've got to share it out amongst the staff. But spinning plates is a great term for that. And it's exhausting because they're looking at you as the knowledge and guidance. But all of them boys come into it with different personalities. There's times in here where these boys have come through the academy that their nose gets put out of joint by these boys signing. Not all of them grit their teeth and just go, okay, it's another bit of competition and I'll push my way through it. So if you're guiding them young players, it's really important. These guys come in a bit like wounded animals. So they're low maintenance, high output, or high in energy, and they're open eyes and ears, but they just had a massive disappointment. But you take joy and success from all of them. But the most important thing for me in my last 3 or 4 years at Liverpool as under-23s coach wasn't coaching. It was the conversations off the pitch and the management off the pitch that put oxygen to what happened on it. And that was my daily thing. And I don't mind saying that when I first got in the job, I actually did think it was about coaching and putting on the most fantastic session. And I learned very, very quickly it was about my skills to communicate with them. We were very lucky to have a lady come in to the club and did a presentation on open questioning. I walked into that room that day thinking, wow, this is 2 hours of my life or 3 hours of my life I don't really want. It was the most important presentation I've ever been in because it was what the skills that I needed at that time. Maybe my coaching skills got me the job. It wasn't going to be that that kept me in it. It was how I understood people, their cultures and background. So that was a massive part. So then I had to develop a model. And I developed a model where I read in a life coaching book and then changing it to football. Because at the time, as I say, I was probably 80% life coach, 20% football coach. These boys could play football. I had to find out what made them play at this level and what maybe was forcing them maybe to play sometimes down at this level. Okay, so I developed this model, individual development, football maturity, the ability to audit yourself. Okay, so two things very personal and two things social. And the idea is to develop this strong identity. So the first thing is self-awareness. What is your identity as a player? So I see a lot of young players maybe get a scholarship playing in Liverpool's youth team or previously in Chelsea that, you know, they wanted the contract, they wanted to be there, they were good players, but how did they impact the game? So this was a constant conversation. What is your identity? How do you impact the game? Once you know that, and sometimes, you know, if a boy tells you he's going to be Lionel Messi and he's not, he's going to be more a level player, maybe the level down of that style, you might have to move him 5% either side. But that's a very strong visualisation for a player. So for me, the easy one is, you're playing at Anfield, you've been man of the match, on your debut, right, you're sat in the stand watching you, what excites you about you? What will the people be saying about you? What's Jurgen Klopp saying about you? What's Neville and Carragher saying about you on Super Sunday? That's right, okay, that's your identity, brilliant, we got it. Okay, how are we going to manage it every day? So what daily rituals are we going to have for you to enhance that identity? Every single day. So you have this team session, within that you have to have your individual session. So how are you going to focus yourself every day? So them two things are very, very personal. Okay, but then it's how do you get this identity within the collective? So how do you make this really strong identity succeed within there? So a few things on that, because that's quite a varied one, number three there. A few things are, okay, you're playing as a centre midfielder, you have a great partnership with one midfielder, and then he moves to the first team, goes out on loan, whatever happens, are you able to put on a different hat to your new partner in the team? Okay. Also, your awareness of the collective is, it may not be that you're the best player in this room, that's not actually the level, is it? So, it's like we're in this room full of coaches, you might look to your right and left, think, okay, I'm a good coach in this room, but that's not actually maybe the level. Maybe the level is something higher and above and beyond. So in terms of awareness of the collective, there's one thing being settling into Liverpool's 23s or first team, or getting to Liverpool's first team to train. What's going to make you a starter in that team? What's actually, if Liverpool can't give you what you need in terms of your ambition and desire, what's needed to play at the next level and above and beyond? So that's a big thing about how to fit in within the collective. And then relationship management, which I think young people
struggle with. So their personality, how they communicate. So a lot of young players fall into the trap of peer adulation. So they'll drive the car that they want their teammates to applaud them for driving, not knowing that at 20, I'm their coach at 36, so that's a bit of a gap. Jürgen's 48. The owners are another 10 or 15 years above. Your social media, not a lot of CEOs now and managers and coaches and fans are viewing you on social media, so how you carry yourself as a person. So who are you trying to impress? And also your perception of relationships in your life. So these things are two things very social. And the last one that I'm passionate about is ownership. You've got to give this over. They've got to be able to audit it. So you can help them. So my communication now will always, and conversations, come back to this. But that's the model, really. So before I speak to you about why Brazil, why did I go, and the experience there, I think you have to understand a little bit about what I was working before, my mindset going into it. And then when I give you my reflections at the end, I think it'll all hopefully come together. But onto maybe a more interesting subject. Why Brazil? So I was searching for more answers. So you go back to 10 players I was working with. Lucky enough, Chelsea and Liverpool to work with the probably elite players in the UK, British players, lots of European players, the odd South American. But it was a chance to do something that maybe very few people from where I'm from will get a chance to do. So the obvious answer is this. Growing up, like probably many people in the room, being wowed by some of them people on there, and then thinking, wow, you're going to get to go and work in the biggest club in Brazil, the most successful club as assistant manager, and maybe see where maybe these guys have come from. Also, the sightseeing was quite good as well. Okay, so it was a nice actual place to live. I never actually met her, by the way. So okay, this guy was very, very influential. His name's Rogério Ceni. Here's some of the stats of his career. 24 year career, over 1250 games, 136 goals as a goalkeeper. He'll score more free kicks than a Roberto Carlos, David Beckham. I think it's a crazy stat. If you put both their free kicks together, I think he's just below them two. To give you an idea, which is quite interesting for us to think that you've got this goalie going up and taking his free kicks. He was captain, I think, for 17 years. He won all major trophies. He was part of the World Cup winning squad in 2002 as well as subkeeper. So he's won that Copa Libertadores, World Club Championship two or three times. All of the trophies in Brazil. Literally is the David Beckham of Sao Paulo Football Club. Cannot move. He was going in as manager. And how we met, strange how things come around. There was a Brazilian club, Deportivo Brazil, who Paul and Jim will know, had a link with Man United. There was a young guy working with them who came over and visited me at Chelsea and then visited me again at Liverpool. He's was very interested in football, but he's actually a lawyer. And now he was the lawyer who did all the transfers in and out of Sao Paulo. And he was actually the lawyer of Rogério Ceni, who was in England on his... He retired the year before and he was visiting all the first team managers. So he'd been in to see Claudio, he'd gone in to see Pochettino, Conte, Ranieri. He was working up the country, basically, Klopp, gone across to see Mourinho. And the guy had said, look, while we're visiting Liverpool the day before, we should go in and see Mike. And that's how it came about. Never met him before, didn't know this guy. Hadn't seen this lawyer in probably 3 or 4 years. Came in, watched the session, had a chat for 2 or 3 hours about some of the ideas that we're talking about today. And he said at the end, get a job at Sao Paulo, would you come? Because he asked me what my dream was it to be a manager? And I said, not necessarily, I would like to go and work abroad. So before I rush upwards, I think I've got a lot of learning to decide. So I'd like to go and work abroad, learn a second language, got a passion about that. He said, well, if I get that job, will you come as assistant? And it's one of them, yeah, mate, thanks a lot for that. But about 6 weeks later, he called my bluff a little bit. Now, relationship with my boss at Liverpool is very unique. A guy called Alex Inglethorpe. He's come from Tottenham. He's a very, very excellent background, Alex. And I'd had a couple of offers to maybe go and be a manager or speak to clubs in League 1 and League 2 the year before, but I said no. I was happy, loved the club. For me, the only opportunity I'd want is if a club from abroad offered, I'd like to go and speak to them. It's not that definitely I'd go, I'd like to go and speak to them. So the club agreed for me to go across. So I flew on a Thursday across for the weekend, and then I saw the facilities, I saw that 67,000-seat stadium, I saw the history of the club,
the players like Kaká they brought through, and I just thought, wow, when am I ever going to get the chance to do this again? So it excited me. It was heartbreaking to leave Liverpool, and luckily, you know, things in life seem to work out, don't they, sometimes, so you end up back. But on visiting Brazil, I just thought I had to. I spoke to a few people that were close to me, and I thought I had to. But not everybody thought it was a good idea. His words, but no, I've spoken to him beforehand. He was very good. He gave me the same advice that he used there in that press conference for a game, but I didn't really need him to understand, because as I say, I'm on this personal journey of you versus yourself, and the advice that I was getting was, Mick, it's very unstable. Mick, it's, you never get to really build a team. All that's true. I'm going to give you the warts and all story about Brazil in a minute, about the goods and the bads about it, but it was just an opportunity to learn. So it was these things, really. It was my dream to go and work abroad, so I was ticking a dream off in terms of a fantastic opportunity. It was my personal development areas, of maybe going to work in the first team, new language, all of them little things. But it was my curiosity and blind spot of watching these unbelievable Brazilian players and South American players, whether it be the Barcelona of Neymar, Suarez, Messi, and Nelson, Neymar, Paris Saint-Germain, with Cavani, Di Maria, the two lads at Liverpool, Coutinho, Firmino. So my curiosity about them, and just wanting to do it. But if I give you an idea of how I work, each year I was lucky enough to sit on a workshop when I was at Chelsea and, a few years ago, and someone came in and spoke to us about this. So I know a few other people that were there at the time, like Paul Clement, and I think he still uses this. Like, we would set aims for the year across them areas, like your personal development, work, family, health, finance, fun. It's like your New Year's resolution at the start of the football season, and you try and tick off what you've done in each area. So wife's got like two nights out a year, me and her, we never ever fulfil that ever, so that's always the area. But basically, why do I do that? Well, it helps you get out of bed in the morning. So 2017 for me was this. Took my pro licence, or I'm in the moment of taking it now, which I think is important for maybe my future development. Working outside England was ticked. Learn a new language was a huge passion. I had to kick on and do it. My parents live in Mallorca. I have done 12 years. My sister went there for 6 months, and she learnt fluent, and I was so envious of her, having spent all her life in a car going up and down motorways to watch me play football as a youngster. She held that against me, and she had the one quality I needed. So frustrating, like the old sibling war was going on. So it was that was important. A big challenge outside my comfort zone. I felt a little bit comfortable. I don't mind saying that. It was a fantastic job. I felt a little bit comfortable, and I was probably getting maybe in a stage where I needed another challenge. And then working in the first team environment, new league, new country. So there was a lot of things there I was justifying it for in my own development. So Sao Paulo, a little bit about the club.
By chance. The Athlete Formation Center Laudonatel is an international reference in the formation of high-performance athletes. Located in a 220,000 square meters area, has modern facilities for sports, educational, and administrative infrastructure. One of the biggest centers of sports exchange, shaped great players that became soccer idols around the world. Built in the 80s, Baja Funda Training Center is where the professional team prepares for the games, carries out pre-season, and also technical, tactical, and physical training. The 44,000 square meters area, located at the city center region, have top quality structure for athletes and technical committee. Nature, tranquility, and extreme comfort. These structures were used and praised by United States and Colombia national teams before and during the 2014 FIFA World Cup.
It's clean, it's convenient, it's situated, pitches are beautiful. I think everything the U.S. was looking for was clearly right here, and there's no doubt the U.S. team feels enormously lucky and privileged to be at this site here.
It's been for us like a second home.
The biggest private stadium in Brazil, Cícero Pompeu de Toledo, also known as Morumbi, began construction in the 50s. Today it has 67,000 comfortable seats and services. Fans, one heart. Inside the field, six national championships. Three times Libertadores da América champions. And three times world champions. Added to so many others, makes São Paulo Futebol Clube the most successful club in Brazil. São Paulo Futebol Clube, among the greatest, the first.
So quite a unique club, I would say, along with Flamengo, the two biggest Brazilian clubs, most successful in terms of trophies gained. So looking at that academy centre there, which they call the Formation Centre, it's like going into Centre Parks. It's absolutely amazing. So out in the countryside, the players live there. So when I saw that, saw the first team training centre in the middle of the city centre, the stadium, and just really took on board the actual size of the club, the size of the guy that was going in. This is like Gerrard taking over Liverpool or Ryan Giggs taking over Man United for the first job. It's a really, really unique moment for the club. So there was lots of good things. But in terms of Brazil, if we talk a little while about football and then about life, and there was positives and negatives, and how I bring that back to learning and that role that I was having before as a youth developer. So in terms of football, as you saw, the facilities and the club were unique. They were fantastic. They were the same size as the two clubs I'd worked in England in terms of, you know, structure and ambition and the types of players that you were working with. In terms of the players, it was a fantastic opportunity. We had a guy called Rodrigo Caio, who's in the Brazilian national team now, will go to the World Cup as central defender. Had Diego Lugano, who you may remember as the Uruguayan captain, played 98 times for them. Three World Cups, has played in the Premier League, has played pretty much around the world. Two Argentinian internationals, a Peruvian, Ecuadorian. So to actually learn and speak to these guys and be someone that's out there and planning the training for them. For me as a coach, I think 36, very, very young coach, unbelievable experience of working with them players. And I'll come back to that a bit later about how they see the game. In terms of the youth system, it's the biggest in Brazil. So it's produced players David Luiz, Kaká, Oscar, Lucas Moura, Hernanes, Casimiro. The list is huge. And as you can imagine, in Brazil, every weekend, the European scouts are there. More so in the academy than the first team game, which is really interesting. But the youth system, it blew me away. The facility, I think, is the best facility I've ever seen. People talk about Spurs have a lovely facility now, Man City have the new one, Man United have a fantastic one, but really and truthfully, when you actually are in that environment in the middle of nowhere with this unbelievable facility, they have a lazy river for, it sounds crazy, man, but to give you an example, they had a lazy river that went around the building for recovery. They had different stones on the floor that come up to your waist, and the players would just walk around it. You're just in a complete different world, and you're talking about young Brazilian boys that have come from the streets that are so happy to be in this system.
because getting into Sao Paulo's academy meant they had full-time education, a good food, healthcare, somewhere safe to stay. You should see the look in their eye, which I'll come back to again later. But to actually be there, you're just like, wow. And a lot of my faults there weren't tactics and the championship. It was always about, wow, development, development, development. So I learned a lot about myself in terms of where I'm at the moment and what my passion is. And then you have people and relationships. You can imagine being a big club, the biggest stadium other than the Maracanã, but no one plays in that. That's the stadium that people rent, the big Rio clubs rent. It's not their home stadium. It's the biggest home stadium in Brazil. Every year they pretty much have the biggest medium in terms of, so we play in front of 57,000, 62,000, whatever. But the people and relationships. So in the change room after the game, a funny story is like you'll see all these actors. Soaps are massive in Brazil. Sometimes you play at 9:45 at night, or you play at 11 in the morning, because they won't ever change the soaps on TV. It's crazy. It's a nation that's obsessed with obviously food, football, music, but soap operas. So after the game, being one of the biggest clubs, they would invite these people in the changing room. I don't have a clue who any of them were, obviously. And one day this little guy comes in, he's going around, and he says, "Michael, can I have a picture with you?" So I say, "Yeah." When he walks away, I say, "Who's that guy?" Like, really nice fella. And they, all the people started falling around. It was Felipe Massa, the Formula One driver. I'm not a Formula One fan. He's just asking for a picture because he's a huge Sao Paulo fan. So you'll see the picture later. He's like my best friend now, but he's not really. But it's a nice story. It's a nice story to have. Now, in terms of the football, the negatives, the schedule was really tough. A game every 3 days, literally non-stop. And with that, that doesn't look too bad. That looks like a League One in England or a Championship sort of schedule if you throw in different tournaments. But not with the schedule in terms of the travelling, the heat, the quality of pitches. So lots of travel. The quality of pitches are not like at home. There's no sprinkler systems at some of the smaller clubs, only at the big clubs or the stadiums that were built for the World Cup. So the pitches we were playing on were something like, you would literally turn up and call the game off here. You would just not play it. But we're playing a top game on it. And so people talk about the speed of the game being slower. That ain't the players. Honestly, I've been seeing the Liverpool players close up, and I've been worked with them and seeing these guys. No, they're very, very athletic. Very, very dynamic players. But sometimes the schedule, the weather and the pitch you're playing on can even it out. But don't get me wrong, if you pick the best players up there, like we're seeing with Gabriel Jesus now at a young age, and pop him in the Premier League, they can really play. But that was difficult. The other thing was the dynamics of how the club was made. So 250 directors elect a president. Okay, so and then they get to come in the change room. So to give you an idea, our change room would be like just off the corner there, but this would be part of it, a bit of like a 3G inside where we'd warm up. Sometimes in Brazil they don't always warm up on the pitch because of the heat or because of how bad the pitch is. But you'd have like 30 directors in there. So keeping things quiet and keeping things within the camp was really, really difficult. Like much more difficult than here. You know, I'm in that culture thing, just get these people out of the way. It's very much a cultural thing. I've got a friend that worked at Porto and said it was very, very similar there. But keeping things secret, like your starting lineup, it was always in the media the day before. It was absolutely crazy. Just little things you couldn't keep secret. And the president was going through an election when we went there, which was a negative because that led to him buying players when he wanted to buy them in line with winning the election. So to give you an example, we arrive in January pre-season, go to Florida. We would like to sign a player for $1 million. He says we have no money. We need to bring in $20 million just to run this season to pay people. About 6 weeks later, 7 weeks later, he bought a guy called Lucas Prato, who was the number nine for Argentina, playing with Messi and Aguero. Bought him for $6 million. We're like, "Oh, Mr. President, we didn't have no money yesterday." Like it was counted in and bought a boy on from China, a very good player, Jusilei, a midfielder, really, really top player. Brought him back from one of the Chinese clubs on loan for a huge amount of money for a loan fee and his wages. But it was all in line of the political of him getting signed. So he signed the players to get the votes and when he wanted them. But that also led to a crazy situation with players leaving when, even though Rogério was so famous, maybe he was a spearhead and it was enabling the president to sort of make money by chopping and changing the players. Where that money went, who knows? But I'm not sure it will come back into the club. So it was, that was a really, really interesting thing that I thought was a negative. It's an experience that, you know, if I get a chance to work at that level again, there's some of the things that maybe I'd scratch the surface a little bit before I go in a little bit and ask a few more solid questions. In terms of the family life, it was amazing. I'll tell you that now, it was incredible. There wasn't anything negative about the family life other than my wife sometimes feeling a bit lonely. My children loved it. So from the weather to the lifestyle and culture was really nice. They don't rush their schedule in the day. There's no need to. The weather's nice. They're very laid back people, very calm, friendly people in what I saw. It's a country that probably gets a bit of bad publicity, and I think when you're there you feel the warmth of the people. Very religious country, very nice people. Family is a huge thing in Brazil. On Sundays, literally everything stops and families will go to the beach or to the park or wherever to get together. Huge shopping centres, they love shopping. More passionate than the UK women, I would say. Like, Brazilian women are crazy for shopping. But at the shopping centres, you have cinemas, gyms, hospitals, everything's there. And you go with your family, and it's really set up for the family life. So for me, I had a lot of good family time when I was in Brazil. Much more than what I did when I was in Liverpool. And we were lucky enough to have a swimming pool at our house, and the kids had a park opposite. We lived in a gated compound about 20 kilometres outside the city. It was brilliant. And then obviously learning the language. For me, it was a fantastic time because it opened me up to the process of learning again in terms of the steps that players might go through trying to get involved in the culture and learning a lot about it. My children started to learn. My children were 2 and 4 when I went. They both had their birthdays there to become 3 and 5. So as a family, we really sort of enjoyed it. But in terms of the negatives, the traffic is horrendous. It's 24 million people in the city, one of the biggest or growing cities in the world. It has the third highest crime rate of any city in the world. So that was another thing that people that wanted me maybe to stay at home were throwing at me, family, friends, colleagues in Liverpool. Why, you didn't move your family to there? But actually, we didn't live anywhere near that. I didn't see anything. I was explaining earlier, our player liaison officer did get shot and robbed for his moped, but luckily for me, I didn't see anything. He survived, to be fair to him, Zicarlos. But so it was there was that underbelly there, but there's a part of Sao Paulo, they have one street called Oscar Freire, which I think is in the top 8 richest streets in the world. It's like a shopping street, it's like Bond Street in London, and there's lovely restaurants on it. So I got to see that part of it, and I lived in a place called Alphaville, which was 20 kilometres outside the city, which was like living in Orlando. Big house in condominiums out the way. Because the city being so big and the biggest sort of power city in South America, a lot of the American companies are there. Downtime was difficult when my family wasn't there. So to give you an idea, I went to Brazil with a temporary visa, then I had to travel to Argentina to get my visa, which I got. When I got there, the guy at the counter in the Brazilian consulate said, "Where's your family?" And I said, "Well, they're in Sao Paulo." Sao Paulo told me, "Just go, Mick, they'll give you your visa, your family's attached to it." When I got there, the family had to travel with me. So there was problems with the visa, where the club probably wasn't used to bringing people in from outside South America, because it's like an EU in South America is a freedom of movement. The fact that I'm from the EU and not South America means I have a certain visa. That meant my family had to go home after 90 days and could only stay in Brazil for 180 days. So they stayed at home for 7 weeks. And let me tell you, it doesn't matter if the sun's shining, it doesn't matter if you've got a swimming pool, it doesn't matter if it's lovely, there's a lot of downtime. And then things probably didn't make as much sense as what they made before, because you've got a 3 and a 5-year-old and your wife living literally a day's travel away, 6,000 miles away. And then when the little issues in the club started coming about, where there was maybe some things you didn't necessarily agree with, then you're thinking, wow, what's going on here? So to give you an idea, the family did come back a month before I ended up leaving the club. But they, if the visa hadn't got sorted in the next 30 days, they've had to leave until February 2018. So it's a pretty big cock-up by the club, to be fair, in that sense. And there was a lot of, oh, like waving arms going on. There wasn't a lot of, but that's a bit of the culture in terms of how they see time and a relax. The media is quite a dangerous thing in Brazil because it's 24/7. It's very passionate. A lot of ex-players on the TV earning money to talk about the game, and something small in training, a pushing match in training that literally is forgotten about an hour later is not allowed to be forgotten about in Brazil. It's made huge news. So something that would just happen in the training session is gone. They film, they're there every day.
watching, and it's extreme. And Rogério being as famous as he was in Brazil, the average life for a coach is 15 games. He made one more game after I resigned, so he made 35, so he actually did quite well really. But you can imagine, as one coach was going, another one, they had a campaign to try and move him with this stuff going on with the president above, which is ongoing now, which was, you know, nearly 4 months ago, which is crazy. So that gives you an idea of like the 360 of the good and the bad. This was a really special day that I can't not tell you about. So the 15th of February, I left on New Year's Day to go to Brazil. On the 15th of February, my family arrived at 7 in the morning. So I didn't travel with the team. The team were playing that night, 9:45 on TV, against Santos in the Clásico, away at Santos, at the stadium that Pelé played in. It was the game that I was looking forward to the most, and it just coincided with my family coming in the morning. We won 3-1. It was one of the best. It wasn't the best game we played, but it was one of the best. This was sent to me by a fan afterwards, of like the emotions of that game, going 1-0 down and then scoring and scoring again. Amazing. I had a video when I was a kid called Pelé, the Master of His Method. So something given to me, I was about 4 or 5 years old, black and white. Pelé's got these pumas on with bits of stitching on them, like where to keep the ball, and he's running around the stadium using a heading trellis to work on heading, showing that he dribbles with his right foot when someone's on his left foot when someone's on his right. And it was in that stadium. So a lot of my thoughts of Brazil were that stadium. To actually go there, and it's only small, it's like 16,500 just away fans. Just home fans, no away fans, because it's a big hooligan problem in Brazil. So they don't really allow away fans for anything outside, only the smaller games when the other team don't have many fans. So what a day that was. It was the best day I've ever had in football, on a selfish note. I'm talking purely me, not boys making debuts or anything like that. On a really selfish note, 15th of February was a wonderful, wonderful day. This was our schedule, so I need to give you this, just to give you how close things were together. My first real game, when I got the pre-season plan, we started pre-season on the 4th of January. They only ended the previous season on the 14th of December. So their league literally runs from February across a state championship and a national championship, from February to the second week in December. And then pre-season starts the first or second week in January. There is no break. So they arrived back here. We played our first game on the 12th, but they weren't even put in. So we were standing at the IMG, fantastic facility in Bradenton, Florida, for 3 weeks. And our first game was going to be River Plate, in front of like 22,000 in Orlando. And I was thinking, shit, we ain't got no pre-season games. And they were like, no, it's okay, like, we'll just play River Plate, is how they were. So quickly run around and managed to get 2 friendlies in, just to get some stuff in our legs, because we're changing a lot of players. But first game was against River Plate, 0-0, won on penalties, semi-final, bang. 2 days later, or the day later, we played Corinthians, big derby. It's the big city derby, so I'm straight into it. Again, 0-0, another classic, we won on penalties, won the Florida Cup. We're off and running. So come home, play Columbus Crew, won 7-0, and then we started. If you see here, we lost our first game. This was crazy. Ex-Brazilian player, may know the name, Vampeta, is the president of Audax. Audax are like a Division 2 team, so we're playing them in the state championship. He moved from the stadium, from a 12,000-seater stadium to a 40,000-seater stadium, tripled the price of the tickets because it's Rogério's first game. Made a press conference, said, we're going to take money off of Sao Paulo. He was a Palmeiras or Corinthians player, so there's a lot of the rivalries, the passion is huge. So the Sao Paulo fans boycotted the game. So you can imagine, the first game of Rogério said, there's 2,000 in the 40-seater stadium, first game of the season. It's just crazy. The next week, we play here, the first home game, 57,000. So you go from 2,500 to 57,000, and it's just the whole thing. So to give you an idea, here is the state championship, and here was the Brasileiro up until our left here. The games in blue are the Copa do Brasil. Copa do Brasil, you play away at Motor Club. There were 17,000 fans waiting for us at the airport. We had an open training session. We played them on the worst pitch I've ever seen. It was horrendous. We actually trained on it the night before, and we didn't want to train. Crazy thing about that is, you play away. If you win, you don't have to play the second leg. If you draw, then you have to play the second leg. So it's like, it's crazy. So it's the same here, look. We play the next round away from home, PSTC, so the second round of the Copa do Brasil.
If you win away from home, you don't have to play. If you draw, then they get the second leg. So you don't go to penalties. Just a crazy rule. Like if they draw, why don't you just take penalties or whatever? But just a crazy situation. Then you go into the two legs. And this is the Copa Sudamericana. But to give you an idea, player loading. 7 games in 21 days in February. So you think of the heat and the travelling. 9 in 30 in March, 7 in 22 in April. So when I got there, I did 23 games in 73 days. Travelling all over the country, playing on different types of pitches and different weather. Had an 18-day break. Then May, we had 4 games in 17 days. In June, 7 in 22. So we had 11 games in 39 days again. It was literally just non-stop. Play, recover, prepare, play. Recover, prepare, play. Travelling as well. Like 6-hour flights, 4-hour flights, 3-hour coach journey. Really interesting. This was our record when I left. Played 34, won 14, drew 11, lost 9. Scored 54 against 39. 22 players sold or loaned. 16 players arrived. And 9 debuts from the academy. Wow.
So it was pretty much, as you can imagine, you're playing all these games. At the same time, this is happening. And you're trying to put a philosophy in and move and merge players from this unbelievable academy with the first team. So in terms of my reflection, knowledge gained for the future, a few things. Need not want. So them young boys I met in Brazil, not every single one of them, but I would say 99% of them, they need to be a football player. And I think some of our children want to be. They need to be. And to give you an idea, not everybody in Brazil is from a favela, but they had this eye of the tiger. Now, luckily, having seen some of the young guys, if there's any Liverpool fans in the room, Trent Alexander or Ben Woodburn are doing okay at the moment. They've got a lot to do, they're doing okay. They have a look in their eye at the moment. Every day at training, it's eye of the tiger. They know that the club are having them, they're living an experience, and they're literally, you talk to them, they're wired in. That's what the kids were like there. So my experience of talking to them and learning about them is, Mick, if I get a contract here, I can take my family out of the favela. If I make it as a football player, I can get out of the favela.